Welcome to those arriving today to Genzoe Sesshin. We've been investigating bodhicitta, awakening mind. And arousing this awakening mind, bodhicittuddhapada, generating, producing, arousing, giving rise to the altruistic mind of awakening. Awakening, arousing bodhi mind, we are one bodhi mind. We vow to hear the true Dharma and drop away all doubts with great trust, and in so doing, the great earth and all living beings together realize the Buddha way. This is a heartfelt expression of bodhicitta from Dogen. To review a little bit, because the people who've been here for a couple days might have forgotten some things, and the people just arriving might not have heard some things. Bodhicitta. Awakening mind comes in a relative form and an ultimate form. Relative bodhicitta is the aspiration, the intention, the wish. These words in English, you know, bring up various things for us. We've been discussing in some detail. Just before coming in, I just thought I'd look up in the dictionary the word aspiration. And it does indeed, it is indeed related to the word breath and spirit. So I appreciate that part of it. And but it's a synonym, ambition. And that word for me is like, for me that word doesn't really work. Ambition sounds so self-centered. We're talking about a selfless aspiration here. So all these words, you know, they're words can't quite ever capture this amazing spirit of bodhicitta. But it's something like a deep intention, wish, aspiration, even resolve or vow to free all living beings from all suffering. So therefore it's based on great compassion. The compassion is wishing that all beings be free from suffering. Sometimes compassion is even said to be being willing to suffer myself for others. That kind of makes it a little bit more challenging. Therefore, it's different from loving kindness, which is just the wish that may all beings be happy, which I think it's hard to always have that intention, but maybe we don't have any reservations. I think loving kindness is, by its nature, a joyful feeling, whereas compassion, the willingness to suffer for others, maybe not necessarily so joyful.
Okay, point. For me, it's the ability to empathize and understand the suffering of others, not necessarily to suffer for others.
Not necessarily to suffer for others, and I think you're right, it's the empathy like that with others suffering. But I have heard that sometimes it's put that it's also the willingness to suffer for others. It's not necessarily like I should suffer, but and I think the part about that is that it's willingness, because it's this extra step of not only may all beings be free from suffering, but I am willing to help work to alleviate their suffering, in which case I might have to suffer. Yes.
Just a minor point.
Yes.
Literally, from the root, compassion means suffer with.
Yeah, yeah.
Passione.
Yeah.
Not separate.
Yeah, not separate.
But I think you're correct. It is experiencing, actually allowing ourselves to experience the pain.
Yeah.
But I think that's maybe a little different than four, but it's definitely got more of a bite than just... just empathy. I'm actually willing to suffer with you.
Yeah. The four part might just be like when it's put into effect, then we might like this person needs some help and I'm going to have to go way out of my way. It's not going to be convenient for me, but I'm willing. And that's, I think, an aspect of it also. So compassion, the wish, which is kind of like the wish that all beings be free from suffering, is part of the foundation for this aspiration of bodhicitta. Right now we're talking about relative bodhicitta, includes the aspiration to actually, or the wish for myself to actually help relieve all suffering, and it includes, it's a two-part wish. It also includes the through reflecting on this, realizing that the best way to help all beings be completely free from suffering is to be a Buddha, to be realize complete awakening ourself, which means freed from my own greed, hate, and delusion, and self-centeredness, so that I can reveal this boundless and untiring kind of responsive compassion to all beings, and develop the skillful means that knows the best way to help all beings. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people might feel like I really do have the wish to benefit all beings, and I take that on, but it might be a little more challenging. Maybe less people have the wish to like, and that what that means is that I have to realize complete perfect awakening to do this. And I would add in a little footnote here. Is this a Buddhist thing? The Buddhists have a monopoly on this kind of vow? I say no. but we'd have to say, it doesn't matter what tradition, but it would involve, I want to free all beings from suffering, and I want to be completely free from greed, hate, and delusion, and develop infinite skillful means. We call that Buddha in our tradition, but any tradition could have that. And part of being completely free is realizing the non-duality of self and others, which maybe could be found in various traditions also. So that's part of relative bodhicitta, is this wish, this aspiration. It's just something that you can generate while you're sitting on a cushion. And then the other aspect of relative bodhicitta is the application. So there's the aspiration and then there's the application. And that's actually like putting it into effect. Okay, I've decided this is my deepest intention, or it is a deep intention, and now I'm going to get to work. So it's sometimes said the aspiration is like deciding to like go to San Francisco, for example, and just really being like totally into that idea. I vow to go to San Francisco, and then the application is like getting in the car and starting to go. As you know, it's a long way to San Francisco. But just to start actually driving. And that this application and the bodhisattva way is practicing, we call the six perfections of a bodhisattva: giving and virtue and patience and diligence and presence and wisdom that sees that actually we don't actually do any of those things. So that's the, that those, you know, include many, many different types of practices and all, but that's the direction. That's putting the wish, the aspiration into effect. So those two together, the aspiration and the application, are the relative bodhicitta. And then there's ultimate bodhicitta, awakening mind, which is the mind of awakening, the awake mind, Buddha mind, Buddha nature. We might say it's like the fruition of that aspiration and application is awakened mind. That's the mind of great peace and freedom, but also the mind with boundless and impartial compassion. Part of the challenge to this bodhisattva thing, right? It's like not just compassion for some people, like the ones we love, but all beings, and equally. Doesn't mean we respond equally to all, but it's like, you know, we'd have the bodhisattva would actually have like equally want all beings to be free from suffering. You know, maybe someone we really don't like, kind of the same as like our family. This is a quite challenging idea, right? And so impartial. And the so we have the relative bodhicitta, the aspiration and the practice that we seem to be actually able to do in the conventional world is you can be united with this Buddha, ultimate Buddha mind. Buddha nature is actually who we really are and is always here from the very beginning. It's not something we create. So in some ways you could say the relative bodhicitta we do actually create. It's called generating, arousing, giving rise to this mind. And the ultimate bodhicitta is unproduced. It's Buddha nature that never isn't born and doesn't die. It's always the case. And we might even say that even the relative bodhicitta, this aspiration, actually is not really us that generates it. Really, if we look more closely, it's more like the ultimate bodhicitta, Buddha nature, actually just reveals itself. And that's what we call relative bodhicitta, if we look more closely. But in order for that to happen, if we have a view of a self that does things, then we use that view of the self that does things to decide to generate this wish. So this is a little bit about these different aspects of bodhicitta in the bodhisattva vehicle. And then we have this essay of Dogen called Arousing, Giving Rise to Generating the Unsurpassed Mind, which is just another name for the awakened mind. And actually, originally, apparently, Dogen called this essay Hotsu Bodhisattva, Bodhicitta Utpada, literally generating bodhicitta. But he's got another essay called Hotsu Bodhisattva. So later, this one was renamed Hotsu Mujoshi, just to make the distinction when talking about them. Same meaning. But when we look at this essay of Dogen, it looks like we're discovering that it seems that this essay is more about the ultimate bodhicitta. It's about this revealing this always awakened mind, which Dogen calls the mind of wood and stone. And And he's going to bring up some relative practices within that, but he's going to talk about how those relative practices are really kind of like unconditioned. So he's really emphasizing the unconditioned ultimate bodhicitta in this essay. And then we have the other essay of Dogen, which is completely, there's no overlap at all between them, although they were written and presented on the same day. But the other one, well, we don't know about written on the same day, but they have the same date by Dogen. The other one is much more about relative bodhicitta and about all these, like, particularly about the compassionate wish to free all beings before ourself. The other one is really about others first, always. That's what the bodhisattva's vow is. This one, he doesn't really bring that up. So it's a nice pair. And the fall of this year will study the other fascicle of Dogen. So we start with the ultimate. I don't know if that's the best idea or not, but that's what seems to be we're doing. It's kind of nice that we studied the ultimate one in Sesshin and then the relative one in a kind of class series, because Sesshin's a time to drop off body and mind. But they have this context of this compassionate wish, I think is good to keep remembering, because Dogen doesn't constantly keep bringing this up. So I think for us, in a relative sense, good to keep reflecting on. I find it helpful for myself. Like one time in Dokusan with my teacher, Tenzin Roshi. Often in Dokusan with him, because of, you know, the inconceivable meeting of causes and conditions, even if I'm having a kind of hard day or something, I'd go and sit down face to face like that with him, and I would just totally like relax and just feel like, actually, I had all these problems that I wanted to bring up in Dokusan, but they all just dropped away. Not always like that, but sometimes Dokusan is like that. I think it's a great blessing. Partly it's the setup, right, of like the formal thing of like you're sitting down in this mind of Zazen, you're stopping, and you're meeting a person who can feel great acceptance and love from. And as I recall some years ago, this was one Dokusan where I kind of like sat down and expressed something like, I can't find any problem. Everything seems to be okay right now. And I think he, you know, appreciated that. And then he said something like, is there any wish? Do you have any wish? And I was like, something like, no. This is like, to try to come up with some wish would destroy this peaceful feeling of ease just being with you. And we even have things like the samadhi of wishlessness as part of Buddha's mind. So like, no, what are you saying? Like, you think I should have some wish? That would be kind of defiled, wouldn't it? And he said, well, you could just see if you you might want to examine whether you might like to have some wish. And I think over time it became clear that he was talking about this bodhicitta, that the bodhisattvas aren't just totally cooled out with like, I don't see any problem in this world. I mean, there might be times in meditation when they actually do totally cool out like that so that they can come back and keep helping, but they seem to have this wish. It's kind of a problem. A wish is, as people have been mentioning these days, there's a little bit of suffering. It's not so pleasant to have a wish. But and my teacher has encouraged me about this wish. And my other Tibetan teacher Sogni Rinpoche, in talking about compassion, particularly compassion, the willingness to suffer for others. On a kind of like, how far are we willing to go? How much are we willing to suffer, and not just, suffer in order to benefit others? Like, I could imagine one example, because we're not just talking about humans here, we're talking about the six realms of all sentient beings. So like, a mosquito might be biting us, right? Are we willing to like suffer the pain of that mosquito bite rather than to actually end the life of this sentient being, which might be kind of convenient for us? That might be not that hard to do, right? To just kind of like, instead of... But that's a little bit of suffering for the sake of relieving another's suffering of a sentient being. So, but then we could get into like... things like, well, we have... Probably most of us have two kidneys, and modern medicine says, well, we don't necessarily need both kidneys. We can have a healthy life with one, and there's some people who need kidneys. So, and it would actually relieve their suffering, right? It's pretty clear. It would actually save their life to give them our kidney. And there's people who are looking for them right now, I'm pretty sure. So I know I have a good friend actually who has somebody else's kidney, a friend of his donated his kidney. I thought that's just amazing, but maybe for a close friend or family, it'd still be pretty hard, right? But a lot of us would probably do that. But how about for a total stranger? Like, there are strangers right now in need of kidneys. Should we like take the next period of zazen and go to the hospital and each give a kidney as a bodhisattva practice? Now, I wouldn't say that this is necessarily like the best thing to do, right? It's not necessarily. Because what if like the next week our other kidney fails and like we have people to take care of? But it raises the question of how much are we willing to suffer, that our suffering really could benefit others. So Sogni Rinpoche bringing up this kind of thing said something like, maybe we're not really bodhisattvas. He himself is a person I consider one of the most compassionate people that I know. He's basically taken care of the life support of like several hundred Buddhist nuns, as well as his own family and many students around the world. And very kindly responds. And he says, when I think about it myself, this bodhisattva thing seems like the best, most important thing, but I don't know if I'm really a Mahayana practitioner, because this is what defines the Mahayana, is this totally compassionate intention. But I'd like to be, and maybe all of us were not really Mahayana practitioners. And then as I read a couple of days ago, the Dalai Lama, who we also think of as a very compassionate being, who's constantly talking about bodhicitta, and he himself says, after like kind of like saying how wonderful and great it is and how it's like the best thing ever, this bodhicitta, he says, I just want to let you all know that I don't even have the slightest trace of bodhicitta. Not even like a little bit. Even though I've been like thinking about it and trying to generate it for the last 60 or 70 years. But I like to. I aspire to have this bodhicitta. May it arise in this being. So this is, one way of talking about maybe relative bodhicitta. It's very difficult to have it really sincere. And also, it maybe can we have for a second, but then to really like, then it goes, it burns out. They say it's like a little spark, and very hard to nurture it, to keep it growing. It easily dies. Yes, Richard.
I'm sorry. The issue to me comes up with an appropriate response when it comes to this not wanting anything to suffer. One thought that comes to me is, for example, an infectious bacteria. You could choose to say, I'm not going to fight it. I mean, I think there are some groups that do say that, but I don't think that's appropriate. I don't think most of us do. But that, is that a sentient being, a bacteria? If it is, and if it's one that's trying to kill us, what's the appropriate response?
Yeah, so there's no set thing about any of this, and I don't know if even, you know, the nitpicky people who try to figure out what a sentient being is and not, if anyone would say that a bacteria is sentient. And then we could get into, well, are mosquitoes sentient? Well, I mean, one thing is, you know, it's like mosquitoes seem to try to escape, which means like it seems like they're trying to avoid pain. Bacteria, I don't know if they ever try to escape our attack. But so it's hard to say what it ever is, right? And we're always weighing these things, and you know, this is all sort of from a very idealistic point of view. But it just, I always appreciate hearing the sort of highest standard for these things, because then it's humbling. It makes me think like, oh, I have some bodhicitta. I want everybody to be happy, but it sounds like. But like the Dalai Lama doesn't say that, right? He says, actually, like, it sounds amazing, I'd like to have this, but I don't. And then the appropriate response is, each situation, like it may be better. And actually there's examples of how you might harm one being to help a bunch of other beings. Like you might actually, if there's no other way to stop like a murderer than killing the murderer who's about to kill hundreds of other people, you might do that. Actually, the Bodhisattva precepts that we'll study in the class this fall, this spring, the tradition does say that the Bodhisattva is willing to cause some horrible karma only in order to help others. And actually they pay the price too. they maybe have to suffer a lot by causing this suffering, but they're willing to do it. So it all comes down to benefit. And also, let's remember too that we are a sentient being that's suffering. So we have compassion towards ourselves. Actually, first of all, we have compassion towards ourselves. So it's not like we don't matter, right? It's just that the teachings are often like for others rather than ourselves, because our tendency tends to be so much about ourselves that it's like maybe kind of skillful means, like when Shanti Deva says, all happiness comes from wanting others to be happy, all suffering comes from wanting myself to be happy. It's kind of extreme, but it's I appreciate those kind of teachings, because it reminds me, yeah, it's so all pervasive, this kind of like the self-concern. So given that context of like this, you know, letting go of self-centeredness for benefiting others, I think that is part of the context of this ultimate bodhicitta. Maybe not even that different. Actually, that kind of thought. In Dogen's Hotsu Bodai Shin, his other fascicle, he says, you use the conceptual thought to generate bodhicitta. You use the discriminating mind to generate bodhicitta, because it's really more about the relative one. In this essay, he says, you use the mind of wood and stone to generate bodhicitta, the non-discriminating, non-conceptual mind. And in that other essay, he says, he's talking about the difference between wanting to be a Buddha. That first thought of wanting to be a Buddha is like this little spark of a firefly compared to actual, unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. It's like this raging firestorm that in comparison. And he says, but if you wish to help all others become Buddhas before you, then that difference between the firefly and the giant firestorm is no difference at all. Which is kind of implying that if your practice becomes completely selfless for others, then actually you have realized, it's kind of implying that you have realized perfect enlightenment. If it's perfectly selfless. So these are all, these points are all in the background. Does everyone have a copy of this? Arousing the aspiration for the unsurpassable. We haven't made it very far in 3 days so far.
6 minutes here.
Okay.
Give me my note.
We're on the last paragraph of the second section between those little stars. With the dynamic capacity of the mind of wood and the mind of stone, thinking not thinking is actualized right now. So we yesterday talked about thinking of what doesn't think, turning the light of awareness around and shining back at the source of mind, thinking of that mind that doesn't think. And this is done. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking is the mind of wood and stone. So with this mind of wood and stone, thinking of not thinking is actualized. Genjo is manifested, actualized right now. And just to review again, because I think he's going to keep talking about the mind of wood and stone, which is a saying from Baijiang, one of the Chinese Zen ancestors. And just briefly, somebody asks Baijiang, how can one attain the mind of wood and stone in all situations? And he says, amongst other things, just understand that the many things do not originate of themselves. All of them come into existence from this impulse of one's own imagination mistakenly clinging to appearances. If you know that mind and objects fundamentally do not contact each other, you will be set free on the spot. So that's how you realize the mind of wood and stone, is you realize that there's no external objects, that they're all your imagination.
Even outside of our perception.
What's that?
Objects outside of our perception are also don't exist.
Well, we could say that in a way, objects outside our perception are not actually objects, unless we're thinking about them, and then they're within our perception again.
That would mean anything outside of what we are immediately perceiving as suffering.
It doesn't ultimately exist separate from us. It doesn't exist separate from us. But it appears, and that's why this thing about the relative bodhicitta and the ultimate bodhicitta always have to go together. Because, like, if I'm just there, like, in Dokusan, and, like, everything's cool, the universe is at peace, it's like, that's only one side. Then there's, like, but there's actually, like, all these beings appearing to suffer all around us, and as long as they continue to appear, including ourselves, then we have this, the way we use our, like, our, you know, plain old conceptual ordinary mind, is we constantly wish to free them all from suffering. And then, you know, we can fall on either side, because one time in another Dokusan with my teacher, we were sitting there in a peaceful moment, and I think we were maybe like, maybe in accord or in agreement that, yeah, everything is okay. And then I said something like, but what about all these suffering beings out there all around us? And he said, forget about them. How about that? And I think so that's like, this is skillful means, right? It's like, in that side, I couldn't stand the peace and contentment of this moment. I wanted to like generate this idea to like, almost like let's go on now to like deal with these conventional beings. And I felt like he was saying, wait a second, of course we're going to do this, but right now, forget about them. Just let's sit here a minute longer. Yes.
My parting word before I leave.
Yes.
One time I was having a conversation in Dharmasana with my teacher, and she said, when I pushed her about something, well, when the student is stuck in the absolute, the teacher needs to push them into the relative. And if the student is stuck in the relative, the teacher's job is to push them.
Exactly.
Towards the absolute.
Yes.
And I think that is just sort of this inherent.
Mm-hmm. You
know, whether it's a fight or a struggle or a what? That's part of this game.
Yep. And so many Zen stories are like this, and you can pull them out, and you can see some of them are for people stuck in one side and some for the other. So always back and forth. Yeah.
And so
will you be cooking lunch?
Perhaps.
To benefit the great assembly?
I think so.
Thank you for willing to do such a conventional thing. Thank you, Sally, for helping her. Bai Zhang goes on. If you're able to spend your whole life with a mind like wood or stone, then you will not be inflated or submerged by the five skandhas or the sense consciousnesses and so on, and the eight winds of the world. The mind of wood and stone. As soon as you see and hear the sound of wind, parentheses, teaching, of the mind of wood and the mind of stone, you surpass the realms outside the way. There's no Buddha way other than this. So this is just that. The wind here means, it's again, Dogen sort of playing with these two different realms. One is like the actual wind that's, blowing through the woods where the wood and stone is, and one of the natural elements. And also the wind means like the style or teaching here. So as soon as you hear the sound of wind, with the mind of wood and stone, where you just hear the sound of wind, this is the way. And also when you hear this particular teaching of Bodhidharma, who said mind is like wood and stone, and Bai Zhang quoting him agreed, then this is also the way. Hui Zhong, great master Da Jung, said, walls, tiles, and pebbles are the ancient Buddha mind. So, same as the mind of wood and stone, that non-discriminating mind, that like walls and pebbles aren't doing anything and aren't thinking about anything. We'd be like a wall, be like a tile or a pebble, and also you could see it as walls, tiles, and pebbles that seem to be out there. Are actually, there's no separation between our mind and these objects of walls, tiles, and pebbles. Therefore, the whole world of of wood and stone and walls and so on is our mind, and this is the ancient Buddha mind. Study where there's no separation. And it's very open to whatever happens. Study and see through the whereabouts of these walls, tiles, and pebbles. Ask, what has manifested in this way? Or another translation, ask, what is it that thus comes? Which you maybe heard that phrase. So this is really like a practice to enter the mind of wood and stone, is to ask, what is it that thus comes? In other words, what is this? The ancient Buddha mind is not bound to the realm of the king of the empty eon. It's being satisfied with each meal. So this is, again, this point about not falling into any side. It's not bound to the realm of the king of the empty eon. It's like, it's not just vast emptiness where nothing happens. It's not bound to that realm. It is simply being satisfied with each meal. That's like in the kind of conventional world, which is very ordinary, and yet that being satisfied with each meal is in accord with, I'm satisfied because this meal, the kind of like maybe bitter taste of this meal is not something separate from me. It's just the way my mind is manifesting now. But we can hear it as kind of like we're talking about the relative and the ultimate and not getting stuck in either. It's being satisfied with grass and water, which one note says maybe refers to like being like a water buffalo, which is one of those Zen things. I just want to be like a water buffalo and just plow the fields to benefit beings. So if we're in that realm as a water buffalo, then we're satisfied with grass and water. If we're in the Zendo, it's literally, each meal is literally being satisfied with rice gruel and rice, which are the Zen meals. Investigating in this way and sitting as a Buddha, being a Buddha, is called arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. So we could say, investigating in this way and sitting in stillness as a Buddha and making a Buddha or the activity of a Buddha are both called this mind of enlightenment. So we could hear it as both the side of stillness of just sitting and the practice of getting up and being and living as a Buddha are both. And it says, arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. So we should just know here that every time that's said, and it's going to be said again and again in this essay, is literally it's Hotsu Bodai Shin. So arousing bodhicitta. So if we hear that as relative bodhicitta, then we would interpret it as arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. But if we hear it as ultimate bodhicitta, which I propose this essay is speaking more from this perspective, then it's actually just arousing or generating the mind of enlightenment. So this word aspiration is just the way that Kaz Tanahashi is choosing to always translate bodhicitta as the aspiration for enlightenment, or in this case, aspiration for the unsurpassable in the title. But it's really just Hotsu Bodai Jin, generating or arousing the bodhi mind. So you might say, well, what's the aspiration here? So that's a little bit interpretive, right? We might try to translate it as, it's called arousing the mind of enlightenment, more literally. Now, the cause for bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, does not lie anywhere else. I'm going to start reading it this way. Every place it says aspiration, let's just say bodhicitta, because that includes both sides. It includes the relative aspiration side, and it includes the ultimate side is actually not an aspiration, right? It's the realization of Buddha's mind. Bodhicitta is aroused by bodhicitta itself. The cause for bodhicitta does not lie anywhere else, somewhere outside of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is aroused by bodhicitta itself. So again, I think this is showing the ultimate bodhicitta side, because bodhicitta is basically equivalent to Buddha nature. And this, in the tradition, these are often equated to the ultimate bodhicitta is another name for Buddha nature. And Buddha nature is not caused by anything other than itself. Buddha nature just is Buddha nature, and gives rise to itself. It's not even really gives rise to itself, because it doesn't arise or cease. But we could talk that way. It's making the point that it's not caused by something else. Whereas in the other essay, Hotsu Bodaishin, where Dogen's talking about where does this bodhicitta arise? How does it arise? What are the causes? He does talk about some causes. Instead of saying it just is caused by itself, bodhicitta in this other essay, he says one of the ways it's caused is, he says it's not caused by, it doesn't come from you. You don't like do it yourself, and it doesn't come from Buddha, which is like our own Buddha nature, you could say. It comes from the meeting of those two. Comes from the meeting of the sentient being and their own Buddha nature, or the sentient being and the Buddha, however we think of Buddha. In that meeting, in that intimate communion called Kano Doko by Dogen, that's where bodhicitta is born. That kind of bodhicitta. And I think this is why it's nice to look at these two sides of relative bodhicitta is born in with a specific condition of a sentient being meeting a Buddha. And it's also born through generating the wish to free all beings from suffering before ourselves. But this ultimate bodhicitta is not born from anything other than itself. Bodhicitta is to pick up a blade of grass and manifest a Buddha image. So we could say, recognizing the potential in everything, including a blade of grass. There's something in the Tenzo Kyokun about this, I think, this blade of grass. Using whatever ingredients you find to make a soup is like taking up a blade of grass and making a 16-foot Buddha, something like that. Yes?
Are you saying that it's more our karmic tendencies that bring it about? And then meeting that
bodhicitta
with vigor, or meeting that with it almost sounds like you need no aspiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in this kind of ultimate bodhicitta, I think that's what Dogen's pointing to here, is that you don't need an aspiration for that. He's kind of celebrating, I think he's trying to bring out for us this ultimate bodhicitta, that where you don't need to do anything. Like the mind of wood and stone, you just drop off body and mind, and there it is. So we don't fall into that side only, then he writes this whole other essay about well, you actually have to like think like this. And he says, you actually use your discriminating mind to do it. And here he says, you don't use your discriminating mind. So it's, you know, it's interesting that, you know, they just chose this translation of bodhicitta as arousing the mind of enlightenment. I feel like that's why I'm feeling the impulse to just start translating it as bodhicitta or the mind of enlightenment in this case, because there's nothing, it doesn't actually say aspiration in the original. But right, we want to remember both sides. That's why it seems very helpful whenever we're in a thinking mind. It seems helpful to direct that thinking towards this aspiration. But if we're just completely letting go of everything in zazen, then we can forget about that aspiration for a little while. And if we forget what we're doing and we're really like, what is this all, why am I in sesshin anyway? Then sometimes I find it's helpful to go to the kind of like discriminating mind. Sometimes go to the discriminating mind. It's like a little pep talk. Oh yeah, I'm like, I actually want to completely realize the way to benefit all beings. Wait a second, do I? Let's look at that. Yeah, I think I do. I'm not sure. What about my kidney? Okay, I want to like open to this, and so and then that kind of like, okay, I'm back. I'm willing to suffer. It's called sesshin. I'm willing to suffer for others, right? So you can actually practice this compassion while we're sitting in sesshin. We might think I'm just suffering for myself here, and I'm trying to get through this. But that little turn, right? You can say, actually, forget it. I don't care about realizing anything with sesshin. But if I leave, probably everybody will start to leave. You know, it happens sometimes. So I'm going to stay here and suffer for a few more days, just out of compassion for these other people who are maybe doing the same thing for me. So it's kind of ridiculous. Why don't we all go home? Because Buddha needs us to do this.
I mean, that is two things that occur. I mean, one, of course, is the medicine way, where one lances and goes through suffering, and that is specifically for the people. Mm.
Native American tradition.
The medicine way. That's exactly what that is. Mm. And personally, I have to periodically go through periods. I get migraines every day, and I have to go through periods where to break the cycle of the medicine causing the headache, you have to do like, what do you call it? You know, when you go through breaking a drug cycle.
Detox.
Withdrawal.
And one of the only ways I can have a migraine for 24 hours without wanting to literally kill myself is to do that. That's almost a necessary practice, is I have to say to myself, all right, I can't have this suffering for nothing. I'm going to say that I'm offering this somehow.
That's beautiful.
Somebody else, and not just get through it. I mean, I don't know if I can get through it without that.
Isn't it interesting? We can do, if we're already suffering, why don't we just turn our intention slightly to let our suffering be for all beings? I don't think we should try to bring on suffering to ourselves for no other reason.
Well, but the medicine way does that. Mm-hmm. I'm sympathetic to that.
Mm-hmm.
We can disagree on
that. Which reminds me of Dogen's teacher, Ru Jing, said the zazen of the Buddhas and ancestors is forever different than the zazen of the shravakas, which are maybe, you know, emphasizing those practicing just for their own personal liberation. And he says the zazen of the Buddhas and ancestors is always infused with great compassion. So he doesn't elaborate, I think, too much on that, but it's interesting to think of zazen as infused with compassion, which is the willingness to suffer for others. So if we want to sit in sesshin like the Buddhas and ancestors, we can let our suffering be almost like you make the wish. May this May everything that's happening to me be for the benefit of all beings. Yes?
Is it appropriate to then bring to mind people that are suffering and do like tone them with them and breathe in their suffering, breathe out?
Yeah, I mean, there are those practices, so we're welcome to do that. You know, it wouldn't maybe be like considered shikantaza practice, but I think there's times we can do that, or to cultivate. We can do anything. We have lots of zazen time here, and it's a free zendo. So, yeah, to actually work on those practices that, you know, like the Tibetan tradition has so many skillful means to actually train the conventional mind, that Zen doesn't have as many as some. So that's one of them, is to actually imagine. It's a lot about using imagination. Imagining suffering beings, breathing in their suffering as, even in the form of like black smoke, if you want to get into it. And I think why add the black smoke? And you could say, well, it's to make this point of that we're willing to suffer for them. I think that's why you imagine it like that. Oh, that's awful, you know? But like, I'm intentionally breathing it in and then breathing out this, like, you know, bright, white, clear light, wishing them well on the in-breath and out-breath. So it's a mind training. It's totally contrived and imagination. But if you do that over and over, it'll affect your mind. Like everything affects our mind. if our mind is constantly internally complaining, that will create the mind of dissatisfaction.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes, Laurie.
So I'm back at the Dalai Lama with I Have No Bodhi.
Yeah. I was a little shocked myself.
So I'm not sure that I think that is even positive or useful. For one thing, how does he know he doesn't have any bodhi? He can't judge for himself. And even if the amount of bodhicitta you have is a little bit or a lot, you know, so it's a lot, big range. It seems to me much more useful to say, I have a little bodhicitta, I want to develop that, to really recognize what you have and what you're deficient in, rather than to say something that seems a little false humility. Which that strikes me as.
Yeah, well.
Really?
We don't know, right? But I was even shocked, because he really got into it. I don't even have like the slightest trace of it. So, but he did say, continuing with that, but I really constantly aspire to have it. So, and you know, we talked about this when I read that passage. I think there's everything that is said in the realm of Dharma, you could see as skillful means, sometimes not so skillful, sometimes skillful, but it's, you know, it not to be, maybe anything that comes out in words is not to be taken literally. Maybe we could even say, go that far. And in such a case, then sometimes, really, really, some of the greatest teachers talk in a very, very humble way, like, especially in Tibetan tradition, there's this style. It's a kind of a style of like what we consider like the greatest masters of all time. They'll give some amazing instructions and they'll say, but all this is like not my own experience. It's just what I heard from my teacher. So they're kind of like, my teacher is just amazing, but like I'd like to realize it too. And then there's another style, both in Zen and Tibetan tradition, of the opposite, of like total confidence and like, you know, I know there's been no other Buddha in the past 1,000 years as highly realized as me.
Yeah. Really?
Sometimes you hear that kind of thing. I mean, Dogen almost sometimes has that kind of feeling. And and I think, again, it's skillful means. It's not, neither one is really true. But sometimes, for myself, sometimes the very humble approach is very inspiring for me. It really touches me, because any sense of like arrogance or thinking that I'm doing pretty good in this practice is almost like that just sort of washes away. And then sometimes when I'm feeling really like, you know, uninspired and like nobody can, this is all just made up, nobody can actually practice and realize the way, like, then you hear these teachers like, no, this is it. I like, my vision pervades the universe. I mean, the Buddha talked this way, right? And then it's, I find that very inspiring too, because it's like, this really is possible. So, don't want to grasp either side. Yes, Jean.
A little bit conjecture, but maybe it's fair to say that inside the I don't have bodhicitta is a deeper teaching of there is no I to have it and there is no having.
Yeah. If we look at his language, I think he does use the word like me and I like that. So yeah, maybe that's the, it's with a, maybe even a glimmer in his eye, right? Of like, I don't have the bodhicitta, but it's coming through this body and mind, like, you know, in a huge way. So it could be that, yeah.
Well, it's a beautiful thing in that sense that he says that in the context of what we see him doing.
Yeah, right.
You know, so we know that everything he does smacks of compassion and reads as compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to say that almost necessitates, I think, genes and maybe some Koan-like aspect mm-hmm. of him saying that, because he's doing the walk.
Mm-hmm.
He says it's not false humility, I don't think.
And I think another possibility too is really great teachers like that. I think they have to, almost like the greater the practice, the more they really have to be careful of pride, right? So it's kind of like for his own practice, he's like, he's talking about bodhicitta, maybe he's thinking like, and yeah, I've got this thing cooking, this bodhicitta, and then he's like, wait a second, you know, like, I want to deepen this more, and to remind myself of how much further there is to go, I'd speak this way. Almost like, so you all can ignore me, but like, I need to say this for myself. Could have been like that too. Like Dalai Lama says, you know, people see me as this great bodhisattva, but actually I think of myself as just a humble monk, a simple monk, he says. So I think that's his own practice, right? And he's maybe, you know, they put him on a giant throne and stuff. It's like you really probably have to really keep these practices of humility. It is this arousing this bodhicitta is to take up a rootless tree and create a sutra of this ultimate bodhicitta. So there's a reference to the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flower ornament sutra. It probably does come from this because it's so related. Somewhere in that sutra it says, bodhicitta is not born from the good roots of merit of sentient beings. So actually it's the same point that Dogen's making. Bodhicitta is not born, and I think this is probably in the sutra, it's talking about ultimate bodhicitta, because conventional is actually born from the good roots of accumulation of merit, actually. But here the sutra is saying this, maybe we say in parentheses, ultimate bodhicitta is not born from the good roots of merit of sentient beings. It's like the tree without roots. It's not born from roots, yet its branches, leaves, flowers, and fruit all flourish. Similarly, the tree of bodhicitta of a bodhisattva, mahasattva, is attained without roots. So this is the Buddha nature perspective. Is the rootless tree, that where all these great qualities of compassion and kindness are the branches of the tree, but at the root is Buddha nature, which is rootless. It has no, it doesn't exist as anything. It's unborn.
Are we talking about a beneficent universe, a universe that has goodwill? bodhicitta and always other than compassion. But, well, I should let you answer that first, but I have a thought.
Well, the universe, meaning like the beings in the universe, do they have bodhicitta?
No, the universe itself.
Well,
the unknown has some kind of, we're assigning to the unknown to the Tao aspects of compassion and bodhicitta. If we do that, I think we have to assign hatred, greed, hate, and delusion in with it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't attribute those qualities to, like, to empty space, if that's what we mean by the universe. And but if
would you attribute bodhicitta to empty space?
No, I don't think so. I mean, unless we mean the Dharmakaya, which is, the Dharmakaya is said to be like empty space, but it's the true body of Buddha. So, and it's realized, the Dharmakaya is realized originally by sentient beings that are manifesting the Dharmakaya. So I think if there's no sentient beings in the universe, it's not beneficent and it's not deluded or greed, hate, and delusion either. It's, you know, those are qualities of life, sentient life. So, but the Dharmakaya would be this one exception, because the Dharmakaya is like vast space. And yet it responds to beings, like the moon reflected in the water.
I don't know how you can make the distinction between one vast space and
another. Yeah, that's a good question. That's kind of a subtle question. Can you make a distinction between the vast space of the Dharmakaya and the vast space of the universe in between the planets and so on? It depends, you know, we have to get into really defining the Tao here too, I think, but I think we can make a distinction actually between just, you know, outer space as defined by science, you know, a vacuum kind of space, and Dharmakaya space. I think we can make a distinction between those, because Dharmakaya space has this inconceivable compassion, and it pervades the whole universe. So something like that. If we sounds crazy. Yeah, it's inconceivable.
Yeah.
But there are such teachings, right? And do we believe them? That's the question. Because the sutra said it, or are we? These are questions too. For bodhisattvas to ask themselves. To arouse bodhicitta is to make an offering of sand or rice water to the Buddha. Sand particularly refers to what we know as King Ashoka, this great Dharma king in India. In a previous life, he, according to some sutra, he offered sand. He was a kid playing in the sandbox, and a Buddha came by, and he's like, I want to make an offering to that Buddha, and like, I'll make a little like, kind of like a little sand rice ball. I'll just pretend, because I just have sand. Here's some rice, Buddha. And the Buddha graciously received the sand. And because of that act of giving, even though it was just sand, inedible sand, he was later born as King Ashoka and benefited. You know, actually, he's pretty kind of harsh king to begin with. Actually killed a lot of people and conquered a lot of land. And then at some point, I think it was his wife. He married a Buddhist wife, as I recall, and she's like, and they had a son, and I think she said
Rama.
Something. What's that?
Rama
was the son.
It wasn't it.
I don't know.
Two sons.
Maybe.
And they fought.
Could be. I the story I heard is that the son was born, and she said, "I'm not going to let you even see or talk to your son unless you completely stop killing." And then that kind of woke him up. He didn't say, oh, okay. He's kind of like, wow, this is like, she's really into this. what's that about? And then he kind of like opened, he aroused the mind of awakening, I think is what happened. And now we just did this travel through India, and Ashoka lived like about, I think 200 BC, a couple hundred years after the Buddha. And he built these pillars where he wrote his edicts that are like Buddhist sayings to help, you know, some Dharma teachings on the road. And he'd put them up at especially auspicious places. So almost all of these pilgrimage sites we visited had Ashoka's pillar that actually Ashoka built. And what was startling to me is that like all these other... There's all these ruins, basically all these places you go in India are like piles of bricks all falling apart, and they layers of different monasteries and things built over the years. But maybe the oldest things often are these Ashoka pillars from like 200 BC, and they're almost none of them are intact. They're mostly broken and halfway. But the parts that are intact, they're about this diameter, this big around, and they're like some kind of, I don't know if it's sandstone, but highly polished, so like totally smooth and totally round, like perfect machined stone things, and they're like 50 feet tall. And to think they were doing this in 200 BC, and that they're still there, and they have this writing that's like, maybe Ashoka didn't carve it in himself, but like all the they're outside, right? Like what is that? 2,300 years of rainstorms and stuff hasn't worn them down. There's still the writings in there, and some really ancient like script that's not Sanskrit or Pali. It's really ancient script, but they've found the code. And so like Lumbini, it says this is the place where Lord Buddha was born, and because it's a holy site, the people of Lumbini are exempt from the local tax. That's what it says on Ashoka's pillar at Lumbini. Anyway, he was benefited many beings. He set up all kinds of hospitals and rest houses and for people around India. Or you could offer some rice water to the Buddha. These simple offerings are arousing bodhicitta. To practice a small virtuous act with encouragement of someone else, or to bow to the Buddha following a demon's deceptive advice, is also bodhicitta. I don't know about this, you know, following a demon's deceptive advice, like a demon's like, hey, go bow to that Buddha. Okay. It's like, well, I don't know about that. But another translation is, which I actually think makes more sense, to bow to the Buddha while being disturbed by demons. I think that's nice. To do small random acts of kindness, right? A small virtuous act with the encouragement of someone else, meaning like, hey, why don't you, sometimes parents do this with their kids. They're like, why don't you give something to this person who's asking for something? And they sort of like, and the kid enjoys giving it. But sometimes it's kind of very easy. We're being encouraged to do it, and it's easy, small thing. And sometimes it's while we're disturbed by demons, so it's not so easy. The demons are like, you should give up this practice because it's totally useless. I mean, maybe do meditation, but things like bowing to Buddha, that's like bowing to like a statue on the altar. Now that's like ridiculous waste of time. You should just sit zazen, or not even. So that's like a demon's disturbance. Yeah. A demon saying, don't bow to Buddha. And I'm actually going to bow to Buddha, demon, okay? You say it's a stupid waste of time, I'm going to do it.
There's something outside of you, like a demon, or is he really believing that, or is he saying it's the demons of our own misthinking?
I can't remember what the character, if it's from Mara, often they translate Mara as demon. In Zen we have this term Makyo, that is like, kind of like strange visions during Zazen, almost like hallucinations, and the Zen instruction is just ignore it and just keep sitting. But the Ma or Makyo, I'm pretty sure, is transliterating Mara. So it's like Mara's, y'all know about Mara, who is the tempter kind of in Buddhism, like the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, and Mara comes like shooting all these arrows, and it's personified as an external demon. But when you look at, you read the sutras, it seems like we're talking about Buddha's unconscious mind is Mara. So our unconscious mind might start saying, it's a waste of time to like bow to Buddha. So that's being disturbed by our demon. Actually, nothing's external anyway, right? Even if it looks like big and green with 18 eyes, flying purple people eater. Actually, that's our mind, too. Hopefully. So, these kind of like seemingly meaningless practices that we do, whether we're feeling good or doubtful or whatever, is all arousing the mind of enlightenment. Further, you abandon the household, and by realizing that your house is not a true house, or you abandon home and leave home. So it says shuke, which is what we use for priest ordination. Shuke tokudo means leaving home. So this is a kind of interesting commentary on what it means to leave home, actually, right? We could say, just from the Dogen talks a lot about what it means leaving home, but from here we say, if somebody asks, if you're a Zen priest, what does that mean to be a Zen priest? We could say, it's realizing or aspiring to realize that my home is not really a home. I think it's a nice way, which means I'm still, like, it looks like I'm still living in it, but it's not really a home. It's not the home I think it is. That's like a leaving home. I think it's a nice way of, one way to look at leaving home. You enter the mountain and practice Dharma. You create a Buddha image and build a stupa. You chant a sutra and recite the Buddha's name. You look for a teacher and inquire about the way. You sit in the meditation posture. You bow to the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. You recite, homage to the Buddha, Namas Buddha. So these are all these, practices that we do sometimes. Just conventional practices we do in this very sesshin. We haven't built a stupa yet, but maybe we'll work on that. Actually, I think Michael Bashist is building a small stupa for our late Abbess Sobhan Catherine Dynas. With that spirit, building a stupa, a monument to honor a great being. Stupas are sometimes said to represent Buddha's mind. Mostly like these places in India where we went, the central place where you practice is usually a stupa. Sometimes enshrine relics of the Buddha. In Zen, sometimes said that actually the relics of Buddha is like the Dharmakaya, like Buddha mind, and it's pervading everywhere. So as soon as you build the stupa, it does contain the true relics of the Buddha. You don't need pieces of bone and stuff like that, because it's formless. The true relics of Buddha are formless. So we could build a stupa in our mind, even in sesshin, and definitely chant some sutras, recite some names of Buddhas, and sit in meditation postures is like they say literally it says the lotus posture, cross-legged posture, but I think it's nice that this is the cause Tanahashi, and I think Norm and Fisher together decided every time it says that in Dogen, which is all over the place, they translate it the meditation posture, because it's not necessarily that it has to be cross-legged, right? But it is in a particular posture. So I think that's a nice, that's an adaptation, right, to the modern world where we sometimes sit in all kinds of different postures, but it's meditation posture. Thus 80,000 skandhas, or aggregates, all phenomena, become the causes and conditions for arousing the aspiration for enlightenment, or become the causes and conditions for arousing the mind of enlightenment. So before, didn't Dogen say, the cause does not lie anywhere else? He does say that. The cause for bodhicitta does not lie anywhere else. Now he's saying 80,000, actually it's 80,000 dharma heaps. It's the same character they use for skanda. 80,000 dharma heaps, which means all phenomena become the causes and conditions for bodhicitta. So is that, are those two contradictory? Maybe not. Because it's all things. All things. The entire universe becomes the cause for bodhicitta, and that's a little bit like saying bodhicitta is the cause of bodhicitta. There are those who arouse the mind of enlightenment in a dream and attain the way. And there's a referring to, it's nice we have these, some annotations to these things, and it was said that in one of these notes in English that somebody in Japan like a few hundred years ago, just like a kind of like Dharma trivia freak, said, I'm going to like find every place in the whole Shobogenzo of Dogen, everything he's referring to, I'm going to research where it comes from. And it's apparently like 10 volumes, much larger than the Shobogenzo itself, is all the references. And so we have some of these notes. And it's interesting, in Dogen's mind, he was pulling stuff from everywhere. So this is like chapter 14 of the Lotus Sutra, according to this note, where it's a peaceful life chapter, and it's something like, for those who uphold, read, and teach the Lotus Sutra, they have all these great benefits. they have a very happy life. And even in their dreams, they have very good dreams, and in their dreams, they do all these practice activities, including arousing bodhicitta. And it goes on and on of what happens in their good dreams from practicing the Lotus Sutra, which doesn't necessarily mean reading the pages of this text, it means upholding the one vehicle. There are those who arouse bodhicitta while intoxicated. So here's this. We have a story about that, of course, right? They're nice stories because they're talking about bodhicitta in all these different situations. This one, this is in Shobogenzo Shukkei, leaving home. And actually Dogen's quoting Nagarjuna's treatise. He says, when the Blessed One was staying at the Jetavana Grove, a drunk Brahmin came to the Buddha and said he wanted to leave home and become a monk. What would you do? At this, the Buddha had some monks shave off his hair and dress him in the robes of a monk. The Brahmin later sobered up and was surprised to discover his altered appearance. And he left. What's this? What's what happened to my... Oh, man. I'm out of here. Some monks then asked the Buddha why he had allowed the Brahmin to leave home. The Buddha replied, "Never in all the past eons up to now has that Brahmin ever thought of leaving home. Now, while he was drunk, it was a small matter for him to think that he wanted to leave home. But because this happened, in a later time, he will really leave home." Practice the way, and doesn't say that here, but I say, become a Buddha. So, skillful means. Interesting, huh? You're just creating auspicious conditions, good conditions. And Dogen goes on about this, about leaving home too. He's like, even if it's not so sincere, go in this direction is still planting these positive seeds. Quite interesting. Mahayana spirit. Others arouse bodhicitta by seeing scattering flowers or falling leaves among peach blossoms or green bamboo. So both seeing flowers fall, as we heard Dogen said in another essay, how do you arouse bodhicitta? The main thing is you just contemplate impermanence, especially of your own life. You see how your life's quickly passing, and if you think about that a lot, you'll actually realize that lots of things you do are quite meaningless, and you just want to practice for all beings. And also the peach blossoms and bamboo refers to these stories that get brought up in Zen a lot, of one Zen ancestor walking in the mountains saw peach blossoms and realized the way, and one was sweeping and the pebble hit the bamboo, and when he heard the sound, he awakened to the way. So Dogen is saying all these conditions without any intention. These are all kind of emphasizing without any special aspiration. Just these simple events all give rise to this mind of awakening. And they attain the way in a deva realm or in the ocean. They all attain the way. All these cases arouse the mind of enlightenment within arousing the mind of enlightenment in body and mind, in the bodies and minds of all Buddhas, in the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow of all Buddhas and ancestors. This being so, building stupas, creating Buddha images, and other practices right now are exactly arousing the mind of enlightenment, the aspiration for directly becoming Buddha. This should not be abandoned along the way. So now we're going to get into a big discussion that we'll save for this afternoon. But these practices are not what we think they are, of creating stupas and Buddha images. It just strikes me that Sashin is such a great place to hear these kind of teachings about doing all these simple and maybe seemingly meaningless traditional practices, because we do so much of them in Sashin. We might feel like, well, that's just kind of the extra stuff around the edges of the true Sashin that's Zazen. But Dogen's really exploring all these little activities of making offerings to Buddha images and things are it's like unconditioned Buddha mind itself. may any merit, any positive energy that seems to have accumulated in our minds here, if there is any, may we release it, offer it, dedicate it, transfer it to all living beings everywhere in the universe, especially those most suffering. May this energy touch them and release their burden into joy. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.